Hello and welcome to Hadfield Education's Good to Great Education webinar series, where I interview the leading head teachers within the UK education system. Today I'm joined by James Hudson, who's the head teacher at Bedford School. Good morning, James. How are you?
Really well, thanks, Lee. Thank you very much for having me on.
No problem. So, James, I always like to start by finding out about how you got into teaching. So where did it all begin?
It probably began at school, actually. I was very lucky at school to be a boarder at an independent school that offered me an enormous amount of opportunity, both inside the classroom, but particularly outside the classroom. And I always wanted to be a professional cricketer. And so the next stage of that particular journey was when I was 19 and I found out that I wasn't going to be quite good enough to be a professional cricketer, which left some thinking to do for the next few years whilst I was at university. And part of that thinking revolved around what I enjoyed doing myself and trying to find an environment where I could pursue the sorts of things that I really enjoyed doing, but also make a difference to other people's lives along the way. So I sort of built this idea around going back into schools where I could help with not only the subject that I was teaching and the sport that I enjoyed and the boarding, which I also very much enjoyed, but could look at helping children's all-round education. So it's kind of underpinned what I try to do now and look at the whole child rather than just part of a child in everything that I do. I didn't want to go back into school straight after university because I thought personally that would be too narrow. I did want to do something completely different to begin with. So when I got to the end of university, I went and worked for Ernst & Young in London. As a trainee auditor. I did that for 2 years. I had it in my mind that I'd do that for 6 or 7 years first, but I spent 2 years getting out of bed every morning and not wanting to go to work. And that was pretty miserable, actually. And at the end of 2 years, I thought I've had enough of this and went off up to Cambridge at very short notice to do a PGCE. Had a great year there, played lots of cricket, scratched that sort of first class cricket itch, which I'd had for a long time anyway, because I used to play against all the counties, and then went off and taught classics in Sydney in Australia for 6 years. So I had a very lucky few years, if you like. I don't regret the Ernst & Young bit at all. I think it was very important for me to have seen something of the outside world. But 2 years was plenty.
So would you say that insight, it rounded you in terms of your teaching and in particular your initial teaching?
I think it helped to have an understanding of where the children that I was teaching might go on to. So, you know, a lot of my friends were working in London at the time, and certainly very few of them were actually working in teaching at the time. So, you know, just to have a view of what the workplace looked like, what the real world was like, if you like, what it was like to work in a job where you weren't particularly happy every day, I think probably an important start for me. I'm very lucky because since then I haven't had a single day in my whole working life when I haven't wanted to go to work.
Fantastic.
And not very many people can say that.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us about your first teaching role.
I was teaching classics in Sydney, of all places. There are about 50 schools in Australia where you can teach Latin and Greek. And I managed to find one of them. Wow. In fact, they found me, really, because when I was at Cambridge studying a PGCE, I saw a handwritten notice on a notice board from a headmaster in Australia saying he was after a classics teacher. And he actually came to England the following week and interviewed a few people because there was nobody studying to be a classics teacher in Australia. And I was very lucky. I got that role. I had to finish off the PGCE, obviously, in England. Got married the day before I went out to Australia to an English girl, and we had 6 years out there, and it was incredibly happy. It was quite interesting teaching classics in Sydney because the boys absolutely loved it, and we had an amazing head of classics there who they adored. But the difficulty was persuading parents that this was a useful subject for their child to be able to study and continue at school. So we had to do a fair bit of defending the classics and trying to promote the classics wherever we possibly could.
And who moulded your early stages of your teaching career?
Two people, I guess. The man who ran the PGCE at Cambridge, a guy called Bob Lister, who was absolutely incredible. He was probably the first person who really challenged me, in the sense of, I don't mean that intellectually at all, because there's lots of people who challenge me intellectually, but in the sense of picking me up on small things all the time and telling me it wasn't good enough. And he would scrutinize every worksheet you ever produce, every minute of every lesson. He was very, he'd go into everything in great depth. He'd be incredibly supportive, but you always had something to come away and learn, and to improve. And so he was a really interesting man to start with. Sandra, who was the head of classics in Sydney, was amazing, incredibly supportive. She must have wondered what she got, to be perfectly honest. I went out there aged 25. I looked like a 15-year-old. And in my first lesson with 33 boys, it was an all-boys school, there was a full-on stand-up fist fight. And she must have thought, who has the headmaster sent me all the way from England? But she was incredibly supportive, really good fun, and she really sought to enjoy every single day that she had. And that rubbed off on me a lot, and it rubbed off on a lot on the boys. And we had a great time together, and we built up a department from really one and a half teachers to about three teachers by the time we left. There was a lot of demand for it, and it was one of the boys' favourite subjects, I think.
Brilliant, brilliant. And where did you progress from there?
Well, coming back to England, we had our first two children over there, so we wanted them to have uncles and aunts and cousins and so on. So we came back. And I wrote round to a number of independent schools in the UK. Independent largely because, well, we might come to this in a minute, but largely because of the extracurricular they could offer, and that was really part of me.
Sure.
And I ended up at a place called Tunbridge School in Kent. Had 10 years there, and did all sorts of things there. So I taught classics, obviously, but I ran a boarding house for 7 years, which I think still is the best job you can get in the certainly in the independent sector. It's the best job you can get. It's a wonderful experience. And I ran the cricket, which was fun for me, hopefully fun for them as well. And I ran the admissions department at Tunbridge. So I had a lot of broad experience there, coached other sporting sides as well, and did various bits and pieces. Ran the bottom half of the school for a little while, the bottom 2 year groups. And left from there to go to Magdalen College School in Oxford as their senior deputy head.
Okay.
Did that for 3 years, and then came here to Bedford School, and I've been doing this for the last 5 years. And this is an all boys independent boarding and day. We've got 1,100 boys from age 7 to 18, and I spend probably most of my time in the top part of the school, so 13 to 18.
Yeah.
But I'm also headmaster of the whole school, so the head of the junior part reports to me.
And in terms of the progression into middle management, when did you realise that it was the right time for you to do that?
That's a good question. I've never thought about my career, and I think this is one thing. I mean, I would say to people coming into teaching now, don't get too far ahead of yourself, because if you're always looking at the next thing,
Sure.
You'll never be happy in your current role. And if you're happy in your current role, the chances are you're going to be doing the right sort of thing. So try and get as much as you can out of what you're doing currently. For me, I did want to run a boarding house, and that was middle management. And I had let the headmaster know that I was keen to do that when I came back to the UK, and was lucky enough to be able to do that within 2 or 3 years. I served as a tutor in a boarding house for those 2 or 3 years, at kind of an apprenticeship, if you like, learning underneath a housemaster called Andrew Edwards, who was absolutely excellent. And had 7 years doing that. But I then got offered a job running the admissions department, which put me onto the management team at Tunbridge School. And that, for me, that I said I'd only do that if I could stay running the boarding house. So I ended up doing very little teaching, as it was, their classroom teaching then. But for me, that was dipping the toe into senior management and seeing if I wanted to do it or not. And if I didn't want to do it, I could still withdraw and carry on running the boarding house and do my classics teaching and get out in the sports field.
Sure. Yeah. And then the progression into senior leadership. What was the path that you followed there?
Well, I think I found that I did enjoy senior leadership at the same time as doing the other things I was doing in the school. So it was probably more by mistake than anything else. I mean, it was a bit of a fluke. I did apply for three jobs at the same time. And anyway, one of them came up. It was the one at Magdalen College School in Oxford. And it seemed like a natural progression. I think I'd had 7 years in a boarding house. I'd had 10 years at the school. I didn't want to spend my whole life in one school. I didn't think that would be healthy. Although having said that, I really admire those who do. I think every school needs a few teachers who stay there for a very long period, because it helps keep you, it keeps a little bit of knowledge in the institution, which you, sure. you know, of the institution, which is helpful to everybody. But I didn't want to be one of those. So, so we knew we had to move at some stage, and it just felt about right after 10 years or so.
Okay. And then taking the next big step into headship, who molded your sort of senior leadership experiences?
A man called Tim Haynes at Tunbridge School, when I was on his management team, he was the headmaster then. He was incredibly supportive and encouraging of me going in that direction. And then at in Oxford, it was a man called Tim Hans, who was the head there, who had both of them had about 20 years of headship experience. You know, they were very experienced. Working for Tim Hans as his senior deputy was an absolute privilege and very good fun as well. You laughed every day, but it was also he included you in everything that he was going through. So I had, if you like, full access to what he was going through. So it was with open eyes, although nevertheless it's a huge leap.
And in terms of your deputy or deputy assistant experience, I've spoken to previous other head teachers who've in their time within senior leadership, they've moved around different sort of areas within school. Is that something that you'd experienced, or was it a case of from one deputy role you then moved into headship?
In a sense, I mean, running the admissions was quite an important one for me in terms of independent education, because it's highly competitive. You know, you're competing for it's not a shrinking market. It's a market that holds still. But if you don't compete strongly in it, you're in trouble, because that's where your income comes from. So working in admissions for 3 years was incredibly helpful. And then being a senior deputy, you see all sorts of things. You know, it's effectively the day-to-day running of the school. So you're dealing with all staff members. And you're picking up a lot of difficult issues which you would be picking up as a head. And I have to say, as a head, I haven't actually seen anything which has surprised me at all.
Okay.
Because of that experience as a deputy, as a senior deputy. However, the level of responsibility is greatly heightened, and that's the bit that is very difficult to get used to.
And in terms of your biggest sort of learn or the one bit of advice you would give to any sort of aspiring heads out there, what would that be?
I think go into it with your eyes open, get as much training as you can beforehand. And I don't mean going to courses really, although you can go to courses and I'm sure they'd be very helpful, but actually get as much on the job training as you can. And as I did, effectively some mentors who will help you understand what it's like. But don't rush it. You know, there are a lot of people who want to be ahead by the time they're 30 or 35, and they come and tell me that. And I said, well, that's great. I said, once you become ahead, what are you going to do for the next 30 years? And when you look at it like that, you've got a 40-year career. Part of that, I think, is being a head. But there are so many other wonderful jobs you can do along the way and so many different pathways you can take in education. Why wouldn't you spend your time enjoying those while you can?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And in terms of building your team, your senior leadership team, what's the importance and how have you achieved that?
I've been really lucky with that. I've got a fantastic team, actually. Very, very motivated, very intelligent, pretty experienced, but also quite ambitious, both for themselves and the school. And actually, I like that. You know, you as a head, you don't necessarily want people who are going to sit on your senior team for years and years and see that as their end goal, because there's a risk of staleness and so on. You want new ideas coming in all the time. You want people who are going to be keen to make a difference in the space of time that they're with you, and I've got that, so I've been very lucky in that regard. So recruitment, put as much time as you can into recruitment. If you're not happy with the first round of applicants, then don't take them. Don't compromise on that front. Go back again and just keep going until you've got someone that you feel is right.
Excellent. And what initiatives are you currently running in school? Any successful clubs or associations?
Yes, quite a lot, actually. There's always something going on. So we had, at the moment, I'll tell you about three things, really. When we had, like most schools are doing at the moment, a really good look at what the future of the world of work is going to look like. We've got an amazing governing body here who've had extraordinary careers in all sorts of different fields, but not anybody, well, one of them, I think, went through education. The rest of them are in different careers. And we thought, as a management team, the way they could be most useful to us is by telling us what they felt the future of their world looked like. And the sorts of people coming into their businesses and the attributes that they had to have. And we could extrapolate backwards from that to our seven-year-olds and say, well, what will our seven-year-olds need in 15 years' time to go into that world of work? And we did a lot of reading around this, as anyone would be doing now, and went to a lot of we hired speakers in and so on. And we came up with two not very mind-blowing things, but they are nevertheless shaping what we're doing over the next few years. One is that is blatantly obvious that these children are going to be entering a highly technological world. Yeah. And therefore, and that has two knock-on consequences for us. The first is that every 18-year-old who leaves here must have a certain level of technological awareness and knowledge, you know, a basic level, if you like. And so understanding what that means is part of our mission. Secondly, if you've got boys who really like, and we're an all-boys school, sorry, so if I mention boys, you'll know where I'm coming from. If you've got boys who absolutely love technology, how are we going to really let them fly? And because there's going to be a huge number of opportunities, job opportunities for them in the future if they are strong on this front. So we hired in a director of digital learning about 18 months ago to look specifically at this area of school life, and we've had an absolutely amazing 18 months, I have to say. And in terms of letting children fly, I think we've created a whole load of initiatives whereby boys who love this sort of thing can really shine. The flip side of this, or the other side of this whole technology thing, is that it's never is the human side, and so it's never been more important to accentuate the wonders of being human and to lift the qualities that are specifically human. So things like empathy, compassion, creativity, imagination, humour, all of these things are really important for the next generation, more important than they've ever been before, and we always think they've been important. So the other two strands to our next few years involve the human side. One is to do with community engagement. So we're in a town, a Bedford school. We're on the most magnificent site. If I turn this camera around in a minute, you just see acres of land with rugby posts up, and it's the most beautiful green open site with magnificent buildings. A great place for boys to grow up, but it's not the real world. You know, the real world is outside these four walls, if you like. We're in a town, we're lucky enough to be part of it. We have a lot of interactions with the town, but we're now increasing that significantly with the idea that all boys who come to school here have had a meaningful relationship in one way or another with the world outside our four walls. So we're creating a whole load of partnerships with local schools, local charities and so on that our boys can help become involved in.
Fantastic. So that's
the second part. And the third part is we've got less of is less prescribed at the moment, but it's to do with entrepreneurial thinking. So we want to create an environment where boys can not only have ideas, but can then run with them and actually bring them to fruition. And that might mean running businesses. And we have lots of boys who run their own businesses whilst they're at school. In fact, we had a boy who left last year who was earning more than the national average salary by the time he left school, which was pretty cool, I thought. He went to university, didn't last long because he didn't rate it very highly and thought he could do better himself. And actually, he's doing absolutely brilliantly. But we want, so it might involve business, but it doesn't have to involve business. So if a boy's got a particular passion and he wants to get a club or a society up and running, he can get a club or a society running up and running. If he wants to build a project around it and then present it to the entire school, he can present it to the entire school. So something which boys can, an environment where boys can just run with things, and let them take off and let them fail, frankly, as well as succeed. Because if you're going to be an entrepreneur later on in life, or if you need to reinvent yourself several times, which I think is one of the upshots of the modern world, you're going to fail several times. You have to be able to put up with that. So that in a broadly speaking, that's what we're aiming at the moment.
Sounds brilliant. And it's also, like you say, it's really, really current in terms of the trends, the number of employers that are struggling with they're not sure how to deal with what obviously everybody refers to as Gen Z or millennials or whichever, because that the way in which they've been educated and brought through to being 18 is completely unique in terms of, like you say, the things like technology and the access to the world, really, and with the World Wide Web and what have you. So we'll probably see the next Steve Jobs from your school then, by the sounds of it.
you might do, you never know. But this particular lad I was talking about might well be one of them. But you see, he's a good example because he doesn't need an office anywhere and he doesn't need a boss. You know, what he's doing is on social media, and it's running social media sites for businesses initially whilst he was at school. He did it for all the local, or a lot of the local businesses around here who didn't know much about social media.
Sure.
And he's now doing it for sort of minor celebrities as well, I think. And he's very good at it, and he doesn't need anybody else for that. And he's a 21-year-old now, and he, you know, he's got a very good future ahead of him because he's a great communicator.
Fantastic. Mm. Okay. And in terms of outside of work and being ahead, you've obviously mentioned you clearly got a love of cricket. So I suppose going to Australia must have been fantastic for you, really.
It was a great opportunity to drag Australian cricket away at the grassroots levels. my first team that I coached won the first game by miles, and by the last game they had been bowled out for 42. So I consider that quite an achievement.
And do you still get involved in cricket at school?
Unfortunately, not very much, to be honest. I'd love to be able to coach cricket sides and teach classics, but I feel like I'm letting people down all the time if I do that part-time, because a lot of the time I can't get there, and someone has to cover and the boys get shortchanged. So I go out and support them. I go out and watch them outside, but it's really hard to get out and do sessions.
Sure, sure. Okay. Well, just a couple of other sort of quick questions, really. So what's your current book that you're reading at the moment?
I've just finished a book by Cesar Pavese called The Beautiful Summer. And before that, I was reading a book by William Dalrymple called The Holy Mountain, which I love. I really like Dalrymple's writing.
Okay. Yep. And what's your favourite interview question?
That I ask prospective candidates, you mean?
Yes.
My favourite interview question, it was stolen from my previous headmaster, who always asked a question about He said, if you had 24 hours free, unlimited funds, and you could be anywhere you like in the world, what would you do? And that's fun because it just taps into people's passions, really.
And your answer to that question was?
I'd go to Calcutta to watch England play a test match against India at Eden Gardens. And the reason for that was the last time they'd had a test there, the fans, there's 100,000 in a concrete bowl. They set fire to the stadium. So I thought it must be quite an amazing atmosphere. Anyway, he enjoyed that because I think he was trying to improve sport at the school at the time. So.
And what about holidays? Where's your favourite holiday destination?
I love going back to Sydney. I've got a daughter in Sydney now, and I've got two brothers in Sydney now. So I like going back there. It's a great place. I love Australia, in fact. We went to Israel last year. That was an amazing place to go. Every square meter of that territory has extraordinary history or current politics. And that was brilliant.
Brilliant. And in terms of work, what's your favourite app?
I don't have one. I'm very bad myself. Having talked about technology, I've got a lot of people around me, and I'm very, in fact, this is a good thing to learn about headship, I think. You don't have to be an expert in everything to be ahead. In fact, you, awful though it sounds, you probably don't have to be an expert in very much, as long as you've got the ability to create an atmosphere around you whereby the experts themselves can flourish and have a head and can pull together in the same direction. So I'm really bad at technology. Having taught classics all my life, that probably gives you a fair idea of what I'm like. But we've got some brilliant people around me who keep me involved on that sort of thing. So good. If you ask me what my how I go on social media, I'm not so good on that either.
I'm sure Mandy will be able to help you with that.
She certainly will. She does all the time. She's brilliant. Yeah.
And if you weren't a teacher, what would you have been?
Well, I'd have liked to have played cricket, but I don't think I'd have been good enough for that. I think the short answer to that is I'd have been a lot more miserable than I am now.
And who's been the biggest influence in terms of your life?
My wife, definitely, who's been incredible and has put up with my jobs moving geographically quite regularly, but also is... I told you about the PGCE teacher who was constantly challenging. She's constantly challenging too, but in a very good way, not a bad way. And she's got a lot of experience her background's marketing, and she's been in schools marketing as well. So she's got a lot of experience, which is helpful in a career from a career perspective. But also, she's been amazing as well, obviously.
And you've mentioned quite a few influences in your teaching career, but if you were to pick one out, who would you say had been the main influencer?
I really don't think I can pick one, actually. Okay. I there have been so many people, and to be honest, now I'm learning from lots of different people now, including most of my own staff. So, if you go into a day where you think you can't learn something new, then you're struggling, I think. And actually, that's one of the lovely things about being in an environment like this, because you're surrounded by so many great people.
Excellent. And if people need to or want to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Probably to email the school or to Bedford School or to phone Bedford School and just ask to be put through to my PA, who is amazing too.
Excellent.
I'll get that in while I'm online.
Yeah, and what I will do as well, for other links and whatnot, I'll put the some of the school social media within the video, so there'll be links and pop-ups and what have you at the end, and people can connect and have a look themselves as well. So
that would be really helpful. There's one thing on there, actually. You might see it on the website. There's a YouTube channel.
Yes.
For the school. And at the moment, this is a school that goes in very heavily for Movember. And the upper sixth boys, if they want to, are allowed to grow a moustache. There's about 60 or 70 of them doing that. The staff are allowed to grow a moustache. We're regularly the top school fundraiser in the country for this. So we raise over £10,000 for charity, the Movember charity. But much more importantly, the older boys aim to educate the younger boys, and also, in fact, people outside the school, on men's physical and mental health. So today, for instance, we've got one of our citizenships days. We don't do PSHCE on a weekly timetable. We collapse the whole timetable 5 days a year. Okay. And so our November citizenship day is all about men's mental health and men's physical health. And the older boys run lessons with the younger boys. And we get various keynote speakers in and so on to build that around. So I'm about to go back to that in a second. But they put together a video. And there's a video each year. And a couple of years ago, it went viral over the weekend. We had about 200,000 views in 2 days. So I would draw whoever's interested in it, their attention to Movember at Bedford School. It's quite an occasion.
Well, what we can do, we can link to that as well. And like you say, people can have a look for themselves, can't they? But it sounds like a fantastic cause. Yeah.
It's a great cause, especially in an all-boys school, obviously. It's a great cause. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you ever so much for your time. I really appreciate you sharing your experiences and your learns along the way. And I look forward to looking at the YouTube video that I'm going to click on now.
Pleasure.
Fantastic.
Nice to speak to you, Lee. Thanks very much.
Take care.
Bye.